So I spoke on an economist panel about purpose, which I think is something that's just become, you know, it's not a useless concept, but it's become absurdly over-egged, as you probably think too.
Yeah, can you give us your thoughts on purpose? Because I think it's a really fascinating thing at the moment.
Well, I think, first of all, I think there's a very important point to make, which is the idea of it as an employer brand is really important. Because I think it's fair to say that none of us really get out of bed in the morning because we worry about the well-being of WPP shareholders specifically. And so having some higher order oblique purpose to why you do the job you do, by the way, is a really important idea. Because we work for an organization for, say, 45 hours a week. It helps to have something that motivates you and provides you with kind of a keel. And a longer-term direction and objective. And also, of course, because of that John Kay insight in the book Obliquity, that interestingly, profitability as a company is something that's best pursued obliquely, a little like happiness. If you want to be happy, don't pursue happiness directly, kind of take up stamp collecting. I'm not specifically saying stamp collecting. But in the same way, one of the things John Kay observed is that the companies that were most focused on short-term profit maximization were by no means the most profitable. The most profitable companies were those which had some what you might call probably higher order oblique ambition, and of which profit was a byproduct. And so Kay's argument is that the idea that because, you know, you might argue philosophically the purpose of a business is to enrich its own shareholders, although over what time frame, you know, it's not a coherent idea in itself. Nonetheless, if you wish to do that, the way to do that is not to engage in activities which are all entirely around profit maximization. In fact, the companies which are pursuing what you might call a goal that's oblique to profit maximization seem to be the most profitable, particularly over the medium to long term. It's a great little book, by the way, as a kind of book which is really about creativity, but is written by a professor of economics. It's a very, very interesting read. So I'm emphatically, Microsoft, which I think always had, I think it was a computer in every home, was their great, you know, organizing mission. Coca-Cola, I think, was refreshment at arm's reach. Those things are really important. And it's worth remembering that people who work for a company, that's, you know, 45 hours of their waking life every week. The idea that the same thing needs to apply to consumer motivation, when you may only spend 0.001% of your mental capacity thinking about what biscuit to buy, and when you don't necessarily want a trip to the supermarket to be a kind of hair-shirted exercise in higher altruism, I think we've got to be much, much more cautious about it. It's interesting, by the way, I think it's true to say that consumers notice why a company does something. I think, you know, consumers instinctively have a perception as to which organizations are motivated by purpose and probably prefer to deal with businesses that are not simply focused on short-term profit maximization. And, you know, I think, you know, there's that kind of thing. John Kay, actually, funnily enough, tells this story of, you know, being in a hotel and everything just seems a bit penny-pinching and miserable. And he goes, I'm rather getting the feeling this hotel has just been taken over by private equity. And they go and Google it, and sure enough, 3 months earlier it was. And so emphatically, I think it's a very, very, it's very, very good for a company to have an objective and a higher order mission which transcends mere immediate self-enrichment. And that seems to pay off, ironically. Now, on the other hand, do you necessarily need to make that explicit and enlist the consumer in that same mission? And my argument is there are probably brands, you know, Coca-Cola, Hilltop, etc. There are, you know, brands which are sort of mega brands, which perhaps can make that kind of thing explicit. and can make it not only an internal mantra, but a kind of consumer mantra. But I would argue that they're limited, and also that the idea at some point doesn't really scale indefinitely, in that if every brand attempts to do this, it will essentially lead to a kind of collective insanity. I also raise the question sometimes, by the way, which is, if you're taking, for example, a higher-minded environmental purpose, sometimes it's better for companies to do good by stealth. And I've got various arguments for that, one of which is, in a way, you don't want to exhaust people's altruism on trivial gestures. One of the things, I met Steven Pinker fairly recently, and he kind of apologized for the fact that he'd been involved in sort of worthy student initiatives to encourage people to turn off their mobile phone chargers overnight. And the reason he began to have doubts about this kind of thing is those are the kind of things which are a bit like pissing in the Pacific. They don't make the slightest difference, really, to saving the planet. But by making people feel they've done their bit, they're in fact a dangerous distraction. And there is this known thing called moral offsetting, which is if you perform three or four self-consciously worthy acts, you have a kind of moral license to do something, you know, oh, well, you know, because I'm a vegetarian, I'm now going to go on a long haul flight to Machu Picchu kind of stuff, which often means that it may be better for people to do good unwittingly. Secondly, of course, there tends to be an assumption that if something, I asked the question, to which I don't know the answer, I'll be completely honest with you, you know, would electric cars be weirdly more popular now if they'd been sold on their virtues as cars rather than being sold as a way to save polar bears? Virtue signaling doesn't scale. And my point is that virtue signaling may be a kind of counter-signaling. And counter-signaling is an interesting thing because it seems to be found only in humans. And whereas if you... peacocks, for example, the tail is a signal. It's a costly signal. In other words, I'm so fit as a bird, I can afford to function, you know, as a feasible organism, even while carrying this thing on my back for purely decorative purposes. So as a mating signal of genetic fitness, it's probably pretty good. Now, counter-signaling is a human thing where you deliberately don't bother to have much of a tail because your status is so high in other areas that you don't. It's rather like a lead guitarist wearing totally appalling clothes and not even washing very much. Because I'm so goddamn sexy on account of my guitar playing, I can conspicuously fail to make an effort. Or, for example, professors with tenure are always as scruffy as hell because it's a way of signaling I don't have to care about this shit anymore. You know,
in that situation, is that because we can perceive an insecurity of people who then, you know, if you're moving all over the place, you're insecure, and if you're insecure, it means you're hiding the fact that you're weak in some other way.
And so it's almost a visible sign of I can afford this weakness because of my. Now, the classic example I always give is if you're a Hollywood A-lister and you turn up at the Oscars in a Prius, okay? That's actually a kind of counter signal. It says, you know, now the truth about that is everybody knows that that Hollywood A-lister could afford a bloody stretch limo if they wanted to. And so there's a signal that they've chosen to turn up in a Prius. If, on the other hand, if you cycle to work and you're the mayor of London, it's patently a choice. If you work at Pizza Hut and you cycle to work, it means you can't afford a car. Yeah. And so the danger of counter-signaling is it's a game that only a certain percentage of the population can probably play. If you're already high in lots of status markers, you can afford not to compete in two or three areas. And so that counter-signaling, virtue-signaling game is something you can, you know, you can pretty much afford to do. There was a woman who recently, in protest against some weird incident, gave up her Cambridge PhD and walked out of the university. Now, I noticed she already had three previous degrees. Okay. Yeah. Now, not many people would have the luxury of walking away from their job with the same sense of kind of self-righteousness, if you like. And so The problem with games only rich people can play is only rich people can play them, and therefore, as a result, what we actually need is not a change in behaviour among 50,000 posh people in London. We need widespread mass change in behaviour, and that requires something that will scale.
Well, I was talking to an African American friend of mine earlier this week, and he said he was talking about slave reparations, and he said his opinion that if you gave every African-American person in this country, say $100,000, a large number of them would want to flaunt that wealth somehow. Because he said there's a sort of thing where, I think the phrase was, you've come up. And if you've made it, you need to show that you've made it. And it's so buried deep in the DNA of people who are of a demographic where they don't have as much money, that is how they would use it, even if a better use of their money would be to start their own business.
It's an interesting one, that the question of that. It's very interesting that if you look at cycle lanes in London, they're incredibly white. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I mean, to a point which is almost embarrassing, I think, because, now if you think about it, there's a very sensible logic to that, which is if you are more recently wealthy, okay. Yeah. Things are different. I mean, if you think about it, okay, nobody emigrated from, let's say you emigrated from Nigeria, you qualified at medical school, you got a job as a doctor in London. Nobody doing that was going, well, effectively, my great dream is to live in London and cycle to work. and so counter-signaling is actually, in a sense, actually, it's slightly unattractive because it's a bit like faux humility.
Yeah.
Or the humble brag, yeah. There's an element to it which is not altogether nice. And actually, I've got an element of sympathy for people who go, I've made some money, I should visibly enjoy it, And that business of playing sort of weird status games where essentially, I suppose what it is, you're exploiting the currency in which you're rich already. Yeah. And there's something about it which is a bit weird. What you notice, of course, is there are areas where people do it. If you think about it, a lot of people counter signal, like Londoners will have a really shit car, or not only car at all, right? Mm. Nobody seems to do it with travel, do they? You never get anybody who basically goes, I always go on holiday in the UK. Maybe I go to France or Spain a bit.
Yeah.
So travel is a fascinating thing. I think travel actually for the younger generation is what cars were to the American graffiti generation. And it's a source of it's a source of extraordinary relative status how well traveled you are, to a point where I think it's becoming weird. Now, the example I gave is I had a kind of audience of people typically in their 20s and early 30s in London. That's the typical audience I talk to because I work in advertising, which is absurdly young. And I asked people to raise their hands, how many people had been to Machu Picchu? It's about 10, okay? How many people have been to see Lincoln Cathedral? 2. without making relative value judgments, okay, you can get to Lincoln Cathedral in a day by train from London, okay? It is possibly the best cathedral in Europe. We can all argue about that. It's certainly one of the sort of 100 greatest buildings in the world, I think it's probably fair to say, okay? Now, the fact that 4 times or 5 times as many people had been to Machu Picchu as had been to Lincoln Cathedral suggests to me that there's something going on with travel which is actually quite, it's runaway signaling warfare.
Machu Picchu is a kind of...
it's a pile of bloody stones, isn't it, really? And you get altitude sickness. I mean, oh, bloody hell, I mean, I'm not sure I'd gain much from going there as opposed to watching a really good Discovery Channel documentary on it in HD, to be honest.
But is there a further virtue where you're going? I mean, distance is one thing. You've gone so far to experience another culture that you've spent money and you've taken time, whatever. So pat on the back for you. And Machu Picchu as a destination is one of the ultimate hippie destinations as well. It's lovely.
But I suppose there's an argument that if you've gone to Peru, you have to go to Machu Picchu because you feel kind of like an idiot not doing it. I mean, I once had a business meeting in Pisa and was about to head back to the airport and realised that if my kids ever said, have you been to Pisa, Dad? Yeah. what do you think of the Leaning Tower? I didn't see it. So in the end, we found three of us got a taxi and kind of took a bit of a detour on the way back to the airport. And I get that. I get that that's going on. But the fact that I imagine you're at a considerable mating disadvantage if you turn up at university and you've never been long haul.
Mm. Yeah, that might be.
You know, I suspect there's a hell of a lot of that going on now.
And look how complicated this is. It's like, are you pretending to be rich? Are you allowed to pretend to be rich because you were poor? Are you allowed to pretend to be rich because you were rich? How rich are you allowed to pretend to be? Blah, blah, blah. I mean, it just feels like there's levels, 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 but we all understand them almost instinctively. Humble brags are okay for certain people. Flaunting your wealth is okay for other people. And we sort of almost instinctively grow up with this without ever reading it or being told. How is that the case?
No, I suppose instinctively, I'm always a big fan, and I've never met him. And when I meet him, I will shake his hand and give him a big vote of thanks. It's a guy called David Rock, who's a New Zealander. I think he lives in New York now, who has this model called the scarf model. And I always think it's very useful because it's five things. I don't think it's exhaustive or complete, but I think it's a very useful checklist. Five things humans really care about. One, that economists don't understand. And two, I think what's interesting is that there are five things humans care about, which they don't always care about consciously.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, these are the kind of things which matter a huge amount to people emotionally, but won't come out in research. And the five things, SCARF is an acronym, and it's status, certainty, autonomy, relatedness, and fairness. And we seem to have an innate kind of mechanism, mental module that cares about these things and is highly conscious of them. Oh, sorry, is highly affected by them without necessarily being conscious of them. You know, in other words, you know, humiliation of a kind. A wonderful example, I think Abraham Lincoln says, you know, if I were to offer someone $500 to spend the day walking around his hometown wearing his wife's bonnet, very few people would comfortably do it simply because, you know, mild embarrassment, anything of that kind, we almost feel viscerally, don't we?
Mm. Yeah.
I've been public speaking for years and your real terror, you know, and the fear of speaking is fascinating because one of the interesting things about public speaking is you have to do it a lot because if you only do it occasionally, you're too frightened to do it. It's very strange. How much do? Do you do quite a few sort of on stage audience of 300 people? It's very weird. When I come back after August, September, so July and August, typically you don't get many speaking engagements. And so you have 6 weeks off. I mean, the professional speaker people go down to Australia and New Zealand for those 6 weeks. And they do a kind of speaking tour of, because of course it isn't summer. And so nobody's on holiday there. And the funny thing is, when I come back to do the first talk I have to give on sort of September the 8th, I'm absolutely bricking it. And you just go, you know, I'm just going to fuck this up completely. I'm going to be a total idiot. And then, of course, you know, the massive fear of public speaking is that, you know, you'll have a Chino incident or one of those kind of things, you know, which nearly everybody I know who does public speaking also goes to have a pee immediately before they go on stage, this kind of stuff. And so the status thing is really interesting because we are status and certainty is a really interesting one because it's something we feel, but we don't verbalize. And I think that's what's so useful about the SCARF model is the things that people feel deeply, but don't generally verbalize for whatever reason. I mean, with status, of course, it's often because it makes us feel a bit of a twat talking about it too overtly.
Sorry, I was just looking up something. Have you seen the order of adjectives thing whereby... Mm. I think that's
it's extraordinary, isn't it? So it's English.
Sorry, go on.
So I think the example is something like a blue 19th century French butter knife or whatever it is. We know you know exactly the order in which the descriptive adjectives must go in English, but nobody who speaks English is actually consciously aware of the rule. It's purely tacit.
Yeah, it goes quantity or number, quality or opinion, size, age, shape, colour, proper adjective, nationality or place of origin, and then purpose or qualifier. But yeah, no one's ever been taught that, and yet we all know it. It's really weird.
No, I mean, it's fascinating, of course, with English tense as well, which is English generally is quite a simple language, but the tenses, the French, I think there's certain aspects of English tense which the French find really, really difficult. The distinction between, is it I went and I used to go and I have been, I can't remember what it is. But all English people know it instinctively. When you've got to teach foreign speakers, it's absolute murder and they'll still get it wrong.
Yeah, and it's like, I think most countries or languages seem to have the tense whereby if you've been somewhere, if you've been waiting a while, you go, I am waiting for 6 weeks, or sorry, 6 hours. Whereas yes. we go, I've been waiting,
yeah.
And we also have things like, I wouldn't...
I know the difference. It's I never met my father, and I've never met my father. So I've never met my father implies he's still alive, whereas I never met my father implies he's dead, and I won't be meeting him anytime soon. Now, again, that's something which, if you're a foreign speaker, you've really got to think about. But which, if you're a native English speaker, you do. It's actually a very interesting sort of segue for me, because one of my contentions about advertising people, whether creative people or good planners, is they know much more than they know they know.
Mm.
And your instincts about what's persuasive, what works, are very, very, actually are far in advance of your ability to explain why. And it's one of the reasons I'm a huge fan of behavioral science, because I think in codifying what is persuasive and actually finding common patterns in things that are persuasive, we actually massively advance the discipline, because it provides us with the means to transfer learnings from one domain to another. So it always fascinated me until I read Robert Cialdini's book, where he points out that actually the admission of a weakness can be a potent sales technique. You know,
yeah, the pratfall effect.
The pratfall effect.
But isn't that like being a person who, if you went up to someone at a dinner party and said, I'm a doctor and I've got two excellent children and I've read these books recently, you'd find them really annoying. I think going back 20 minutes, the fact that you don't signal everything, or you're the guitarist who hasn't washed for a while, there's something appealing about the, whether it's the pratfallness or the fact there's a chink in your armor, that
yeah,
as a person, then you should do it as a brand as well.
There used to be, wasn't there? There used to be a fantastic end line for Brute in my childhood, which was an aftershave for your younger
listeners. Slap it on.
Like but there was also the line, was it Brute, which was for men who don't have to try too hard?
No, I didn't know that.
Is there, there definitely was a line for an aftershave which said for men who don't have to try too hard, which was, you know, again, that's a kind of wonderful insight there.
But to say you can buy cheap your cheap aftershave at Boots because you don't try too hard, I'm not sure that's what they meant. You don't try too hard so you can buy shitty aftershave.
No. It was just one of those points about counter-signaling, which is that, you know, in a sense, not bothering can be a signal of ability, that kind of thing. I mean, actually, when I was at university, you know, the mathematicians did it to a degree, which was kind of... the interesting thing about maths is, to be honest, you know, whereas a hell of a lot of academic subjects are as much about how hard you work or how nerdy you are, to some extent with maths, you could either do it or you couldn't. And there was a guy who used to get a first every year in maths, and the maths tripos was 2 days, 4 exams, morning, afternoon. He used to come in at lunchtime between the morning and the afternoon, and he'd have a pint. Now, you know, my brother was a pretty good mathematician. He couldn't believe this. And he was saying, no, it helps me relax. To be absolutely honest, I think it was a fantastic, you know, it was a fantastic demonstration of, I'm so fucking good, I can do this. Puff, pissed. I always thought that was amazing.
But I think the opposite is something I find with someone like Madonna. She seems so utterly desperate to be famous and successful and whatever. It's somewhat kind of unappealing, particularly... now at this stage of her career. I feel like
it's weird, isn't it? Because yeah, you could have done a Catherine Deneuve, and you could have done a kind of, you know, all those great, the Hollywood greats who were actually, it became extraordinary grand dame.
Mm-hmm.
And you're absolutely right. There's something weird about that, isn't there? And by the way, I don't think this is a sexist judgment, by the way. I think a guy who behaved the same way would be equally weird. You know, if George Clooney at the age of sort of, you know, 58 started turning up everywhere in cycling shorts, you know, we kind of, you know, we wouldn't really, we go, this is kind of weird.
Yeah, I'm not saying necessarily it's because of Madonna's age. I mean, she's always been desperate and hungry for this fame. And I think maybe in the 80s or 90s, it sort of met such a high level of success, it wasn't such a big deal. But now it feels like there's definitely a hole inside her that she's trying to fill with continued validation as a person. And if you're trying to be cool, massive inverted commas, trying too hard is a sort of self-defeating element to it.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because, there's something a bit weird about that, isn't there? Which is, I think people find it... I suppose having achieved a reasonable degree of success, you should try and wear it a bit lightly in some way.
And I think with the Rolling Stones, they have their gigs, and we're all cool with that because we don't really see it. Rolling Stones are touring the world all the time, I imagine, and we're not really aware of it that much unless they come to your hometown. They don't really release any music anymore. So it's kind of like you go, okay, we'd all like to see a Rolling Stones gig, but it doesn't...
Yeah, of course. Who wouldn't? Yeah, I agree.
On stage. Yeah.
No, it is fascinating that, isn't it? Which is, I think, you know, there's a kind of brand lesson there as well, too, which is, you know, brands have a license to do certain things according to age, you know, how venerable they are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I suppose, you know, the classic one would be sort of Jack Daniels or something.
Yeah.
You know, where you can simply behave in a way and speak in a way which, you know, essentially means, you know, essentially, you know, not many brands have that license, but you have that license, and in a weird kind of way, you should take advantage of the license, because if you don't, it's weird.
Yeah, you should recognize that element of it. But it was when Cristal was being co-opted by the rap community. Every rap song mentioned Cristal, to the point where the guy who ran Cristal disavowed this connection. I think, you know, there were little undertones of racism about it. And then Jay-Z said, right, we're going to be talking about Krug Rosé from now on. And they started talking about Krug Rosé. So it's kind of a little bit weird that they didn't want to be associated with the wrong brand. And I think this happened to Burberry about 15 years ago as well. It had become a brand that was too popular. And that meant that it was...
The most fascinating case of what you might call unintentional brand explosion. And I suppose it happens. I mean, two other examples of that are BlackBerry, which weirdly, because of BBM, for a period of about 4 or 5 years, became a kind of youth brand from having been a business brand.
Yeah.
That was highly anomalous. You mentioned Burberry, which was a strange one. And there's a... there's another one as well, which I've briefly just forgotten. Jägermeister must be. Yeah, it must be. So it was apparently, you know. And the other weird one, of course, even weirder still, is Bucky. That it's made by monks on some island in the Severn Estuary or whatever, and it's and they're basically collecting herbs and generally distilling it, and it's effectively drunk by Scottish alcoholics.
A friend of mine told me last week that one of the benefits of it is it's a very good weapon. Once you finish drinking it and you're very drunk, you can smash it and it's a very good weapon. So it's
God. It's also got caffeine in, isn't it? It's got alcohol and caffeine. So it's a kind of double hit, I think. So I'm not entirely sure what the hell the ingredients are. And the Jägermeister was this kind of Austrian liqueur brand, which for whatever reason... and no one was more surprised than the manufacturers themselves, became this absolutely cult. Someone must have invented the Jaeger bomb as a concept, and it somehow spread. God knows what was going on. But it became this absolutely cult drink among American students for whatever reason.
Yeah, and they tried to do that. That just happened.
Well, it raises a question I've wondered about, which is maybe, okay, you're not entirely... Everything about advertising and marketing is driven by a kind of pseudoscientific instrumentalism, which is, we wish to achieve this, therefore we will do that. And that is defined as the thing that is most likely to achieve this.
Yeah.
Each thing being a specific planned outcome. Okay. Yeah. Everybody understands this instinctively. If you're a teenage guy, or I imagine girl, okay, if you ask a teenage guy, why are you going out on Saturday night? He'd answer perfectly happily, I might get lucky.
Mm.
Okay. The reason he's going out is not because he has a specific plan or goal or objective in mind, but simply because he knows that the chances of getting lucky, define it however you like, are inordinately higher if he goes out than if he stays at home. You know, if he stays at home, the odds of anything lucky happening are pretty low. This is, I think, is why young, old people like me who basically go, you know, basically my pattern of life's now fixed until death, you know. when you're middle-aged, you basically go, no, I'm never going to do any of those things. I probably will do those things. Now, if you're teenage, of course, the future path of your life can stretch from destitution to winning the goal in the World Cup final kind of thing. And so the variance of your possible future is much, much greater. And so you expose yourself to things where there's a positive asymmetry. And famous people are much more... Now, I have this weird thing where, okay, my book came out. It's a kind of marketing psychology behavioral science book. If you'd said to me, how do you think you ought to promote this book? I wouldn't have said, let's get on Chris Evans' breakfast show, right? It so happened that someone who's a friend of Chris Evans had heard of the book, and the breakfast show happened to go to Cannes for a day, and they interviewed me, and then Chris quite liked the book, so he plugged it the following day. Fortunately, Oprah hasn't picked up on it yet. but your chances of positive, fluky outcomes. Now, if you think about it, the downside to fame, if you're a reputable person, the downside to fame is very small. Stalkers, I guess, is the downside if you're an individual. If you're a brand or a business, there are no downsides to fame unless there's a scandal that hits you. The upsides are immeasurable, but generally immense. And so a perfectly reasonable probabilistic strategy is just to say, be famous rather than not famous, because you're more likely to be lucky if you're famous, and luck is generally biased towards being good. People will ring you up with good ideas. It's easier to get people to work from you. People will return your CEO's calls. Someone who's got a great idea for a partnership gets in touch with you first because you're the most famous person. Now, all those things, particularly if you're a B2B brand, I think, have an enormous effect. They don't count. The only thing you measure is the thing that the advertising is supposed to achieve. Yeah. And so we're probably hugely undervaluing advertising because the only thing we measure is what you might call the intended effect, and far bigger overall, maybe the unintended effects.
Yeah. There's one thing I was going to ask you about, that effect of intrinsically of advertising, because... I think it's fair to say that people are somewhat mistrustful of advertising. I think, in the same way that we've instinctively learned the order of adjectives, I think we kind of screen out the first, say, 20% of what we're ever told about an ad, because, you go into Burger King and it's got this beautiful burger, and the one you actually buy looks like someone trod on it, and you go, oh, yeah, you're showing me the best, very best version of the thing you do, so I'm going to only believe a certain percentage of it. And I think advertising's taken that to a sort of nth degree and go, well, people don't 100% trust what we do anyway, so let's do this thing where we take a product benefit and exaggerate it. And, if people exaggerate things, they kind of, you trust them even less. So is the inherent mistrust that we have given to advertising something that we should be trying to stop for greater effectiveness, or is it something you just kind of lean into and accept?
I'm just thinking that among those things which is kind of the truth well told, that's actually a little bit of a weakness and a bit of a strength. It's finger licking good is kind of interesting, isn't it? I think that's interesting, which is one of the things I think is that we might all be guilty of this idea of exaggerating the good, because ultimately what appeals to people about brands is the elimination of the bad. And this goes back to this fascinating conversation which David Ogilvy had with a guy who's still alive called Joel Raffleson. Joel must be, I suppose, 90 now. His dad was Samson Raffleson, who's the scriptwriter for The Jazz Singer, would you believe it? And was also the scriptwriter for most of Ernst Lubitsch's films like Heaven Can Wait and so on. And his son, Joel, an extraordinary guy. I mean, just utterly, utterly amazing guy. I met him in Chicago, and he talked about this conversation he'd had with David Ogilvy in, I think, the early 60s. He kind of founded Ogilvy Chicago with his wife, who was also a copywriter. And He said, I don't think people buy brand A rather than brand B because they think it's better. I think they buy it because they're more certain that it's good.
Right.
And his argument, I think, would really chime with some of the later work of decision scientists like Herbert Simon and so on, and Gerd Gigerenzer, that what we see a brand as is a guarantee of a low chance of downside variance. When you buy a Samsung television, the premium you're paying is not really because you think it's a better television, but because you think it's less likely to be crap.
Yeah.
And if you think about the way humans have to factor risk in the course of their lives, avoiding catastrophe is much more important than attaining perfection.
Yeah.
In evolutionary terms, particularly if you understand that life's path-dependent and non-ergodic. In the sense that, you know, if you think about it in real life terms, economists think of utility as being additive. You gain a bit, you lose a bit, you gain a bit, you lose a bit. No, no, no. It's not like that at all. If you have three misfortunes happen to you in close succession, it's a real disaster. You know, maybe, you know, maybe it's not, maybe one of the three things would be perfectly affordable. But if you have them in close succession, it's a disaster. So avoiding the chance of downside risk is a really natural human instinct. And we pay a premium for brands because we see reputation as a guarantor of low downside variance. Yeah. If I buy the Samsung television, it's going to be somewhere between good and very, very good. Now, that's avoiding bad is the most important thing in that decision. It's not the difference between good and a bit better. And once you understand we're calibrated like that, I think you understand what advertising does in a different way. And actually, maybe we spend far too much of our time as advertisers trying to magnify positives when what we should be doing is kind of minimizing negatives.
Yeah.
It's complicated. I mean, okay, if you take a case of a, I mean, on the other hand, I mean, let's take that, one of my favorites, the Saatchi's ad for Intercity, you know, which showed, you know, the Relax.
Yeah.
Okay. It is a hugely exaggerated view of most people's train journeys, to be absolutely frank. Yeah. But what it does do is it focuses the attention on the part of the train journey which you don't get if you travel by car. In other words, you get 2 hours basically where you're not stuck in a steering wheel, you're not stuck in traffic. Now, admittedly, it doesn't show the hassle of getting to the station, boarding the train, buying the ticket, having to find a taxi at the other end. But what it does do is it focuses on the area where the train has a comparative advantage. Now, yeah, okay, it patently exaggerates that. But what it is doing is it's what Robert Cialdini would call in persuasion. It's directing attention to the upside of the equation. And Cialdini's insight is that it isn't a question that we pay attention to what's important. We think important what we pay attention to. And so advertising, the Latin being to anima advertere or something, to direct someone's mind to something, works by essentially increasing the perceived importance of an aspect in which your product enjoys a comparative advantage. And so, to some extent, advertising will always be a bit of an exaggeration because it will talk about the positive aspects of something rather than the negative aspects.
But we could go back to the signaling thing as well, whereby, you know, whether it's death cigarettes or something like that, where if you practice honesty or some sort of straightforwardness instead of trying to, you know, convey this lifestyle that no one's really going to live on the back of your product, there's no element of that. But if everyone did it, it wouldn't work.
I mean, there's an honesty about the downside, which is actually a very clever strategy, which is if you're very cheap, being explicit about the negative might be a good strategy because people go, I get it. The reason I save money at IKEA is because I have to carry this bloody sofa to the car myself. Right. Yeah. Now, if you didn't have that weird bit of negative to it, as with low-cost airlines, they're very explicit about what you didn't get. You don't get a pre-allocated seat. You don't get luggage. You don't get a free drink. You don't get a free meal. You know, you don't get, you know, all that stuff. It made you feel, I'm saving money here, not because they aren't servicing the engines or they don't train the pilots. And so by being explicit about where a saving comes from, you're actually making, you're destigmatizing low prices. which I think is quite interesting. It's a bit like the way I always phrase it is that there's a very big perceptual difference between cheap strawberries and pick your own strawberries. Pick your own strawberries has a narrative about why the strawberries are cheap, which is I have to go out into a field and does that exist in the US? I'm not sure. I grew up in the, you know, the countryside, so pick your own X was a huge craze. And you know, you get the deal. You go, okay, we get a load of, we basically fill the fridge with sodding strawberries, more strawberries than we know what to do with. And we can afford to do that because we're putting in the labor component ourselves. And of course, you've got to choose the strawberries. Cheap strawberries raises the slight doubt of, well, if there isn't anything wrong with these strawberries, why isn't he charging full price? And so, I mean, the interesting thing is, yeah, finding what the mental constraint or obstacle is and then overcoming it. And of course, depending on what brand, and I always talk about this, which is we're always looking for these weird rules in advertising. But of course, context is the huge variable. And just as you can use advertising to justify a price premium, you can also use advertising to destigmatize a low price. So we think of IKEA furniture as being cheap. We don't necessarily think it's low quality. We think it's cheap because the experience is painful, not because the product is poor. I think we're right to think that, by the way. I don't think IKEA is deceiving us in that. It's just that we need a plausible story we can tell ourselves about where these savings come from.
Absolutely. So one question I came to me at the end of your book was that, so there's a kind of, I think what you say is counterintuitive thinking can lead us to both gold and lead. How can you maximize the gold and minimize the lead if what you're doing is sort of taking moonshots? I mean, I guess you'd be suggesting they are not just guesses, but educated guesses. But it seems like some of the solutions are so, you know, counterintuitive that it may feel like, you know, which one of these is worth pursuing?
I think what I probably recommend in the book is, what I certainly don't recommend is turn your whole company into some batshit crazy experimental lab where nobody knows what's going on. I think bees get it right, which is they have two separate functions, one of which is exploiting what you already know, and the other one is engaging in random experimentation to discover what you don't yet know. And there's always, just as there has to be a trade-off between maximizing the profitability of your existing products and spending on R&D, there has to be a trade-off between what you might call the optimized, you know, optimizing the value of what you already know and can do versus simple experimentation. You know, and the point I make about experimentation is don't just test the things that make sense. Mm-hmm. You know, actually test things that economists would say could never be true. And someone's actually just started a Twitter feed about this, which is, I suppose, Loon Shots is a similar book. There's also a guy who's an investor who says whenever he hears someone say that idea doesn't make sense, his ears prick up. Because there are huge advantages to doing things which don't make sense. One of which being that generally, if you discover something counterintuitive, the information is 10 times as valuable as intuitive information, simply because no one else believes it.
Right.
You know, loads and loads of people have been busily trying to produce nicer tasting drinks than Coke. It's Red Bull who really enjoys the gains because they're doing something that nobody else at first was trying to do.
But are there dozens of disgusting drinks out there that weren't Red Bull?
I don't know, because I never drink those things like Monster and whatever, because I'm a Red Bull, absolute Red Bull purist. You know, it's the daddy, as far as I'm concerned, in the category.
There's a sort of survivorship bias where we hear about Red Bull and Monster, but we don't know any of the ones that failed because they failed.
Oh, no. But, I mean, I think the interesting thing is, I suppose, that it's the counterintuitive thing that creates a category in a funny kind of way. And there's an interesting way of putting it, which is also that it's a very interesting definition of innovation. Real innovation occurs when the metrics consumers use to choose a product flip. So if you take, for example, the digital camera category, for a whole period, it was all about how many megapixels do you get, right? You know, megapixels. Now, to be honest, once you hit about 24 megapixels, who cares? Who gives a shit, to be honest? To be honest, A, your bloody files become too big. B, unless you're taking pictures of Kim Jong-un to be displayed on buildings, there isn't that much value to having any more resolution. Most of the shit's shared on the web anyway, where the resolution's fixed. And so the interesting thing there is that what happens is someone comes along, in this case, GoPro.
Yeah.
And does something which is, you know, probably on the megapixel front, the early GoPros weren't all that great. But it's innovative because suddenly what it's doing is saying, okay, these are all the category norms. Everybody here is competing in this space in a kind of, to some extent, a race to the bottom, where we gain our kind of Schumpeterian rent through early adoption. Schumpeter's great belief is that, you know, there is a first, you know, an early mover advantage. Yeah. In these new categories, we gain that Schumpeterian rent through basically being the first person to go sod the megapixels. The fact is, you can attach this to your whatever bike or, you know, my base jumping days are over. So I don't actually have a GoPro. That's a really interesting case where you just, in a sense, what you do is you go, everybody here is focused along this line. What we're going to do, Kano theory also captures it, which is the idea that there are kind of threshold attributes to a product. It's got to do this job, or those are table stakes. Okay, if you don't, if you buy milk and the bottle leaks, I mean, you're not even in the game. Okay, yeah. Then there are kind of performance attributes, which is like how good the milk is, and then there are these things like delight attributes, which are almost orthogonal to the function of the device. And the way I always describe it is the eject mechanism in a cassette deck in the 1980s. You know, logically, it shouldn't have been a major major determinant of which cassette deck you buy. But you pressed eject, and if it went clack, that was rubbish. And if it went pshht. Yeah. And so those delight attributes, Kano was Japanese, worked at the University of Tokyo, and I think worked with the consumer electronics industry in Japan. And also, of course, interesting in consumer electronics is that thing which is that the opposite. It's also a great idea. The opposite of a good idea is also a good idea.
Yeah.
So, you know, there've always been those two schools of thought with hi-fi, haven't there? You know, you've got a fucking great graphic equalizer, 9 knobs, 7 dials, or you take the kind of name, you know, high-end British hi-fi approach where you have an amplifier, volume. That's it. You have one control, one light, which is on, off, standby. That's it. And so the interesting thing with Kano theory, again, is that as Kano's argument is that, to be honest, performance attributes, which sit between threshold attributes and delight attributes, at some point they hit the law of diminishing returns, which is no one really cares about an extra 2 megapixels once you've got... I mean, I remember, I think my first digital camera... I think the photos were 2 megapixels, were they? Or maybe 3.2, something like that, okay? Now, obviously, that's, you know, we could do better than that. Once you get into the kind of high, you know, mid-double digits, that kind of measure for performance starts. And I'd argue with things like train punctuality, okay? To be absolutely honest, I mean, I find it a bit weird because people complain about train punctuality. Now, what's weird about that is that if you'd made the same journey by car, that journey could have taken anywhere between half an hour and an hour and three quarters. Mm. And you kind of know that. And yet still, when your train's 5 minutes late, people grumble about it. I mean, maybe it's just bollocks. I mean, maybe it's just like talking about property prices. It's just like dogs sniffing each other's asses. It's just the kind of conversation people talk about because it's, emphatic kind of... I often wonder about that. Genuinely, are you so anally retentive that your train being 4 minutes late really bothers you? I mean, my argument is, okay, once punctuality reaches a certain threshold of expectation and reliability, you're best to actually stop focusing on that because that'd be silly, you know. And now start looking at actually how comfortable, productive, how you can design trains so they're pleasant to sit on, all that, you know, station furniture, all that other stuff needs to start getting more attention.
But is that down to people's expectations? Because if you said to them, the train will arrive at some point between 1:45 and 1:50, you'd be okay. But they're specifying a very definite time, so you feel let down by that. And it's kind of like...
It's funny you say that, because actually they were criticised, the railway companies, for what's called timetable padding. And timetable padding is where you give a slightly pessimistic view of journey time so that you tend to meet your expected arrival time.
That's how Ryanair was on time.
And my view is, I think timetable padding's okay. Mm. Because, okay, you give me a worse expectation and I arrive a bit early. Well, everybody's happy. I'm not late for the meeting. You know, if anything, I'm a bit early for the meeting, okay? You know, obviously, timetable padding would be, you know, a bit silly if it became ludicrous. You know, if you said, I'm afraid Watford to London takes 3 hours, 3.5 hours. Oh, no, it's only 30 minutes. That would be silly, okay? But actually, timetable padding by 6 minutes, my view is it's probably net hedonic positive, I would say.
I was once told that Adrian Vickers' way of doing things, if he was going to be late, if he knew he was going to be 10 minutes late, he'd always say it was going to be 15, because then he'd arrive at 10 or 12, and yeah, everyone would be delighted. But I think human instinct is still very much to...
Because I'll just be 5 minutes late, and then you turn up 15 minutes late. No, I think Adrian Vickers is right there. Likewise, by the way, with delayed flights. Say delayed 60 minutes, and then when you actually take off only 45 minutes late, the punters actually view it as a bit of a win. Yeah, no, I think we can apply that to everything. And, of course, the interesting thing is that... so much of our perception of things is not weighted against some weird objective statistic. It's against expectation. I've noticed this, by the way. If you read a TripAdvisor review of a restaurant and it says the food's great, but the service is a bit lousy, then actually you turn up and you don't mind the fact that the service is a bit rubbish because you are like kind of expecting it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you hadn't read that review, you'd be sitting there going, God, this service really is crap, isn't it? And also you might think, do I take this personally? Is the service brilliant for everybody else and they're just being shit to me? You know, so you might misread it that way. So the extent to which prior information and prior promises can change our perception of things, I think is really, really interesting. And, of course, it's interesting because, you know, if you're Eurostar, objectively, you're slower than flying to Paris, probably.
Yeah.
But the difference is not the duration of time. It's the quality of the time on board. You board the train. You sit in your arse for 3 hours, whatever it is, 2 hours, 45. You get on with a load of work. You get off the train. You're in Paris. Now, the same journey, if undertaken by air, you're basically being shunted from pillar to post on about 5 separate occasions. It's a completely different nature of time. And that's why I always argued that actually making the Eurostar faster was to some extent missing the point, because we were already taking the train when it was slower.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not even sure that, to be honest, reducing the journey time, it did produce High Speed 1, which was valuable to East Kent. I didn't factor that in at the time. I thought it was just for the Eurostar. But to be absolutely honest, I think most people would have gone by train anyway, simply because in terms of productive time, loss of productive time, the plane's much worse than the train is.
Well, and also you have too many variable factors whereby the plane could be late, the journey to the airport could be late.
Very, very good. So the variance, you see, the train's either on time or it's not on time. Whereas you're absolutely right. This is why I actually keep your commute simple. If you can have a one-stage or two-stage commute, there's only one opportunity for something to go wrong. Whereas the second you have a journey which involves a train, then a bloody tube, then a bus, the margin of error you've got to allow every day to make a 9 o'clock meeting becomes ridiculous.
And the plane itself, I've just experienced this coming back to LAX recently, but you don't know what you're going to encounter at the customs end of things. And it's always like, oh, you turn around a corner and suddenly there's a gigantic queue in front of you. It feels like the air travel is fraught with annoyances whereas if you go from London to Gare du Nord and you're in Gare du Nord and you get out.
Well, we actually forget. Weirdly, they ought to actually make that more salient because, of course, you get off a train and there is nothing. You walk off the train and you're in Paris.
Yeah.
You walk off a plane, you've still got baggage collection, customs and all that other shit waiting for you at the other end.
Yeah. Yeah.
And actually, weirdly, it never really occurred to me, that highly important distinction. I travelled down to Cannes on the, well, I travelled down to Marseille on the train and then took a further train along to Cannes, which I do every year. And it suddenly occurred to me, once you arrive in Marseille, there's no kind of dicking around at the other end. You just waltz straight off the train. No, it is interesting, isn't it? Because we often, until our attention's drawn to things, we may judge things, i.e., you know, for good or ill, in a surprisingly sort of haphazard and silly way. You know, I always tell that story about the, you know, the bus to the airport. And my argument is, I always sort of hated a bus because I just thought it was the kind of crap, less posh version of an air bridge. But I didn't really think about whether there might be a benefit, which is it drives you all the way to passport control. And it was only when a pilot pointed that out that suddenly I became kind of neutral on the bus.
Well, the bus to the airport's got another factor that I think is quite interesting, that first off the plane is first on the bus, which means you're waiting longer than the people who are last off the train and probably behind them in the queue to the passport thing. So you've lost front row advantage because of the bus situation. And I think that probably annoys people as well, because they think, why the fuck did I have to... I
paid for a business class seat, which theoretically means I'm the first person to the passport line.
Yes.
And now, of course, the bus has essentially disrupted our hierarchy. Well, that's interesting because, of course, you could, if you wanted to, you could probably solve that problem.
Yeah, have a little business.
If you partitioned the bus a bit.
Yeah.
And preserved order in that system. I mean, actually, at a very large airport, it doesn't matter very much because you arrive at a passport control where, I mean, actually, what matters when you arrive somewhere like the US is the worst thing you can have is a huge party of people who don't speak English ahead of you in the passport queue, who take literally 20 minutes each to process from some really weird country. And then you're, have you not joined Global Entry? You need to join Global Entry.
There's a green card thing that's going to be way too boring and complicated to go into on this conversation. But yes, that's the next stage.
Yeah, it's actually kind of worth joining because it also means if you join Global Entry, you do have to turn up at the US Embassy, only to discover that you're not allowed to take a laptop into the US Embassy, nor can you leave it anywhere. Just a warning to any of your listeners who are thinking of signing up for Global Entry, don't take your laptop along to the US Embassy to sign up. But it also means that in internal American flights, you tend to get trusted TSA pre-check, so you don't have to take all your crap out of the bag. So it's a double win, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. Just going back to a slightly previous conversation, when you said that you reach a baseline and then, you know, there's other stuff on top of that that then starts to become a differentiator, I was going to ask about clothes, because clothes clearly just, you know, they'll keep you warm whether they're from Gucci or Primark. How is such an enormous industry being created off the back of essentially made up bullshit about whether one is better than the other?
It's incredible, actually, because the expenditure on global fashion and beauty, and I think I'm fairly sure that's entirely defined as non-essential. In other words, fashion doesn't mean, you know, practical work boots. It means actually clothes bought for some purpose other than to protect the body. I saw a presentation at a luxury goods conference, and I thought there was a mistake because the figures were in thousands and the y-axis was in billions. And I realized, no, this is right. It's like $3.2 trillion a year is spent on fashion and beauty, which is more than the world spends on education, interestingly. I suppose the simple factor is that clothes have, they're a drug. I think the really huge industries are basically drugs, okay? If you look at the world's massive industries, we'll leave Pablo Escobar and El Chapo out of this. But tea, if you think about it, coffee, tobacco, booze, right? They're mood-enhancing substances. And the best way to look at clothing is it's a mood-enhancing substance, which is that inevitably and invariably clothes and how you're dressed affect. I mean, this is what, you know, what's it, Abraham Lincoln's point about wearing your wife's bonnet. That's the opposite. You know, if you had to wear If I mean, I don't know how much you'd have to be paid to go into, I don't know, to go into work in a wetsuit or something, without being able to explain why to anybody. You'd want a lot of money to do that, wouldn't you? Because the feelings of kind of pain and discomfort would be pretty acute. And on the opposite level, what obviously happens is that clothing fundamentally hacks the way we feel about ourselves. So the interesting phrase used here is this guy who I mentioned in the book, who's a fascinating Cambridge psychologist, talks about wider placebos. And okay, if you think about it, we can't consciously control our heartbeat or the dilation of our pupils or our digestive system. They kind of run on automatic.
Yeah.
But what we can do is we can hack them. So if you want to make your pupils dilate, you go into a dark room or apparently look at pornography, fascinatingly. And if you want to decrease your heart rate, you can practice yoga. If you want to increase your heart rate, you can go jogging. But you can't control it directly. I can't just sit here and go heart rate up to 88, you know, down to 77. There's no conscious control. So you have to control it obliquely. And the analogy I use in my book is it's a bit like if you're now a sort of adopted Yank, so I'm fairly sure you drive an automatic. You're not some weirdo European with a stick shift. No, okay. Now I'm a total convert to automatics, love them. My argument being that 95% of my driving is either stuck in traffic or on the bloody motorway, in both cases of which the automatic's better.
Yeah.
I also like creep, you know, negotiating car parks and narrow spaces. Now, a lot of purists go, no, I don't like the automatic because you lose the sense of control. And I would say, no, if you drive an automatic for any length of time, the same car, you have exactly the same level of control over the gearbox, but you do it obliquely rather than directly. You don't change gear with a lever. What you sort of do unconsciously is you kind of throttle off a bit to stop it changing down at the top of a hill or something. And you don't even know how you're doing this, by the way. It's like exactly those adjective orders. But you do control which gear your car is in using the accelerator, but you do it in a kind of indirect way. And in the same way, in controlling our mood, we can't just go, be happy. Next 2 hours, I'd like ecstasy level 9. But what we can do is buy things which indirectly affect our level of happiness, contentment, in the case of clothing, confidence, for example. So they put us into a particular mood state, which is necessary for social situations.
Right.
If you think about it, it's kind of weird because the annoying thing with being married is that if you think about it, I'm going to make this really slightly dubious point here. But about women's clothing, okay, Islam's definitely got a point, hasn't it, right? Because you dress modestly when you're out, and then when you're at home with your husband, you put on all the Gucci shit, right? Now, I don't want to grumble, but Western women do the opposite, don't they? Sit around the house in bloody sweatpants, and then you say, we're going out, and then out come the cosmetics and the hosiery and the fancy stuff. Well, don't want to be rude, but if you want to stay married, that's kind of the wrong way around, isn't it? And yet, if you think about it, you know, fashionable clothes in that, you know, are donned for a social setting when people get home from work. You know, generally they kick off their shoes, all the other stuff happens.
Yeah,
I have to say, I think Islam's got a point there. I think the burqa should be, you know, I have to say, I can see the logic there. But that's my job finished anyway. I think the only way you can say it is that it's a mood-altering substance, and it happens to be a cloth rather than something we ingest.
Well, I think all that comes down to the sort of belonging, sort of whether tribalism or otherwise, there's that deep instinct that in Sapiens he talks about a lot, whereby being ostracized from the group is a very, very deep thing for human beings to want to avoid. And therefore, whether your clothes are emo, black, fingernail kind of thing, or you're super Gucci'd up, you want to belong to your tribe. And, you know, you can do that with, you know, with clothing. And I think that's something very important.
It's also interesting because if you think about it, it's much more necessary in cities where you're coming into frequent contact with strangers. So there's a really interesting paper about this, which suggests that there are various things that seem to drive luxury goods expenditure upwards. Now, if you think about China, okay, you've got gender imbalance, okay? Mm-hmm. That's one thing. So there's a surfeit of blokes. Urbanization, which means you move away from people who already know who you are to engaging repeatedly with people who haven't got a clue who you are, and the capacity to reinvent yourself. And the wonderful paper is about this, and it suggests that if you want a really blingy place, the oil industry does it, because you get too many guys, okay? Because the oil industry tends to create a very, you know, Dallas, for example, and you get a whole load of people moving in from everywhere into this new reinvented area. And the paper basically explains why Neiman Marcus started in Dallas, not in Boston.
Right.
Because in Boston, where you have old money, everybody's, you know, been around for 70 years. You know, if you think about it, if I turned up in Monmouth, where I grew up, town of a population of about, I don't know, 14,000 or something. Genuinely, if I had a pair of Moschino sunglasses on, everybody would have just taken the piss. Because, you know, basically, you know, people know where you live, what house, where you go to school, who you are, who your parents are. The need to signal that kind of thing isn't very acute. On the other hand, you move to a city and the need to prove things to strangers becomes much, much more important. And then you have the, you know, the absolute extreme where you put a lot of highly competitive people in the same place. Wackle. I don't know if you remember that. You know, basically, basically, there's a huge spike in Diane von Furstenberg sales on the eve of any kind of Wackle event, because you have, you know, a whole bunch. Now, blokes have evolved a non-compete clause, which is the 12-year-old dinner jacket. You know, the shittier the better. And so that's going to be an egalitarian solution. Now, unfairly, I think there isn't a female equivalent of that.
Mm.
I've actually asked women this question, which is, would you be happier if 3 days a week we all wear sort of boiler suits to work? Yeah, they'd be red Ogilvy branded boiler suits. I think it'd be cool, because I think it'd make you look like the headquarters of a James Bond villain. You know, if everybody went around in red boiler suits with protective helmets, I think it'd be really cool. But, you know, would it be nice if you could just opt out of the whole makeup and clothing regimen for 3 days out of five? But if you have a bunch of people who are highly competitive, and very, very sensitive. It's also noticeable on things like flights. You know, you get real status anxiety in flights because you've got a whole load of businessmen who are senior within their own home setting,
yeah,
because they're known to be the marketing director or whatever. Mm. Actually, I don't know if that's senior anymore, but anyway, we'll ignore that one. But actually, suddenly you plonk them on a plane, no one knows who they are, hence the American Express whole series of commercials of "Do you know me?" You know,
right?
You know, the need to establish your credentials among strangers, and clothing's one of the ways you can do it. And it's interesting when you think about it. Okay, Apple never really won the desktop war because desktops aren't portable; they're just inside the home. But the more portable and visible something is, the more that brand effect becomes really potent.
Yeah, and that's the white earphones being an absolute work.
The white earphones being a work of genius in that respect, aren't they? Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. I mean, I think I've asked most of the questions I wanted to ask you. And also, I think we've done just over 3 hours.
We haven't done
three
hours.
Not today.
Just in total. I was going to see 11 o'clock in the evening. Right. Yeah. Okay, excellent.
So, if you send me the stuff, I'll kind of make the...
So should I pause, should I stop recording now and let it do it? Because it'll take about 10 minutes to do the processing, and then I'll send you the link.
Yeah, there's no huge rush, whenever you can, because I think there may be some topics that we covered in the previous one, so I'll go through the whole thing and try not to keep anything too repetitive.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, it's been a huge pleasure, and I'll give you a shout when I'm next in LA.
is a podcast that watches Christmas. If this is a podcast that watches Christmas.